Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Chilluminati Podcast, episode 364. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined today by just one of my two LA boys, Alex Fassiani. Hello, Alex.
Oh, no. Hey.
Oh, no. Don't worry. We filled the seat real quick and relatively easily because we're also joined by one half. Anytime Jesse's out, I will make it sound like we can just replace him.
You just want to keep him in check just in case.
Yeah, I want to keep him on his toes. I want him to know at any moment he could go. Because today we got one half of the Pixelit podcast, which is a weekly podcast that covers a honestly surprisingly deep breadth of video game novelizations and tie-ins. We have Kevin from Pixelit. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to just be your replacement 40-something-year-old.
We're all in that age range, man. It's all right.
I think that's the millennial role in life, is being the replacement 40-year-olds for people.
Replacement level 40-year-old. Yeah.
Yeah. And I stayed a man-child so that I'm fresh for anything. You know, my mind's right. Fresh.
That's the key.
I have a youthful spirit. Yeah. I'm sad that I don't get an of LA today. I'm just like an LA guy today.
Just the LA guy. Without Jesse, you weren't, because Kevin, we're not from LA, correct?
I'm not from LA. I live in Florida and I'm from the Philadelphia area originally.
I'm a New England boy too.
Yeah.
Out in Texas.
Yeah. 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 It's tough being dislocated from the Northeast, but I survive with my family, down here in Florida. We're doing our best.
Yeah, not the worst weather in Florida, not the best, but not the worst.
Yeah.
That's like California. It's California, but with vividness is how I describe it. It's
California with vividness.
California, but sweatier,
I'd say. Yeah, exactly. So we've both been on Pixelit. I got to say, you know,
I read an ass book.
The thing is, like, yeah, it's always hard when you have a podcast with guests on where there's like a bit of like pre-reading, and I was happy to do it. It's very easy for me. I read very fast. Same. But it was probably the weirdest background information that I've ever been asked to ingest before doing a show. I read the Road Rash. The motorcycle Sega Genesis arcade game where you like beat people with bats and sticks, and it was not a compelling story, but it was great. It was so good.
And I read the Blaster Master book, and I remember very little.
Yeah, there's not much to remember, except that it is literally a retelling of the Blaster Master story that you would have gotten from, like, the instruction manual. And, you know, they just filled in with some extra fluff.
Excellently novelized.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful books.
And then he got in a car, and then he got out of the car, and then he got in the car.
Oh no, the car's falling. Ah, it's gravity or whatever the hell.
Yeah, I think that was how the book went, actually.
Yeah, pretty much.
You've been doing this for a while now. I have to know, what is the worst video game novel you have ever read? Is there one that you just have on like the shelf as like nothing could beat how bad this is?
Yeah, it's Dark Souls, The Mask of Vindication is the worst.
Interesting. The Dark Souls would not be what I thought.
So bad. It is... I can't even remember the author, but it's somebody famous, Dark Souls. And it was so disappointing that I do get angry a lot on the show, but this was probably the angriest I got. Okay. It was Michael Stackpole, who, if you are a Star Wars novel fan, you're very familiar with Michael Stackpole. I love Michael Stackpole growing up. X-Wing series, all that fun stuff. But Star Wars, The Mask of Vindication, basically, it felt like Michael Stackpole had a half-finished draft of a fantasy novel and just like sprinkled some like Dark Souls shit in there, like bonfires and souls and whatever, and weird time stuff, and was just like, here you go. Here you go, guys. This is it. And Dark they Souls. Just ran with it. Dark Souls. The flip end of that spectrum is the book I'll say everybody should read. That is a game book is Sacred and Terrible Air, because that was written by the Disco Elysium guy. Before he made Disco Elysium, he wrote this book, Sacred and Terrible Air. And it is so weird and unique and Eastern
European. No surprise
European.
That would be fantastic. Yeah,
it's fantastic. So I definitely Robert Kurvitz's Sacred and Terrible Air is worth a shout.
Hell yeah. And that game was that game. You know, last week I just did an episode about Grand Theft Auto V and how all consuming the game was, and Disco Elysium was all consuming in a completely other way. Like what a crazy world that was.
Yeah. Phenomenal game.
Yeah. Okay. So since this is your first time on our show. Wow. What happened to my voice?
First time on our show.
I want to
just talk about deep Russian accent for the rest of the show.
I want to ask you. I just had a little bit of Disco Elysium left in me.
yeah, it just came out.
I don't know what
chaos
happened there.
Magic, yeah. Chaos magic.
In the context of this show, pretty much everybody who listens to it always says, "Oh, I'm a Mathis," which means like I'm like Fox Mulder, basically, or I'm a Jesse, yeah, which basically means I'm Dana Scully, or I'm Alex, which basically means like I'm Tony Shalhoub in Galaxy Quest is a metaphor I use often. I'm along for the ride. I enjoy a good tale.
Yeah.
Where do you fall on that spectrum when it comes to like the paranormal, the unexplained, the conspiracy theories?
Yeah, I would say I wish I was an Alex, but I'm actually a Jesse.
is that because you feel like it's an injustice when things don't have explanations? Is it like you can't let it go? Yeah.
I think that's kind of where I land on that. I can't let things go, even though I wish I was able to kind of just go along for the ride a little bit more. Hey, you know, working through therapy, might be autism. I don't know. We'll find out.
Hey, bam, 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 bam.
The club.
Yeah, the podcast world. Welcome.
I'm not autistic at all.
At all.
This is not just me info dumping for 3 hours a week.
Yeah, I didn't just turn my hyper focus and fixation into a show.
So that aside, because you're a skeptic, a lot of the time the explanation comes along with it. But have you ever encountered anything in your own life, or has anybody in your family, is there like a family story or a local legend in your world that comes to mind when it comes to the paranormal or conspiracy theories, or even just a favorite that you have?
Honestly, no. My family is, you know, pretty straightforward, emotionless Germans. So there's not a lot going on there.
Even if expected haunted Germans, they would tell them to go away and they don't believe in you.
We have expected everything that's ever happened.
The everything that I've experienced that could have been a supernatural phenomenon had an explanation. Ultimately, that explanation was my dad playing a prank on me. Sort of like, yeah. Yeah, like when my brother was watching The Exorcist, my dad climbed into the air conditioning vent.
Oh my God,
Jesus Christ.
And whispered through it during a quiet moment that Captain Howdy loves you to my brother and his friends. So that was,
oh my God.
That was
dad was fucking bored.
Is your
that
dad
day.
Johnny Knoxville?
Welcome to Jackass. That's nothing actually ever happened, but
that's like pure Jesse. Yeah,
it is. You actually gonna fill the role rather well today.
Yeah, that's pure Jesse, honestly. Jesse's like, if I saw it in real life, I wouldn't even care.
Honestly, the skepticism is welcome on this episode, because what we're talking about today is actually kind of already well known out there.
Yeah. I mean, look, I love when what we're going to talk about crosses over with like what the guest talks about. Like, I love that.
Well, I was going to say, video game boys here.
That's also true. We also all are. Yeah. We're for years video game people. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's where we all started. It's where we all like our content has started from 15 fucking years ago and on. And one of the most well-known topics from even when I was young and had heard about it. And one we even covered through you, Alex, very briefly in one of the kind of like listicle episodes is Polybius, which we have not covered in full and improper on the show at all, which surprised me when I was like, should we do this?
Yeah, I feel like it's notorious enough that it deserves to be given like at least, you know, one episode's worth of attention, right?
Yeah,
because it's a pretty fucking amazing story. It's pretty like great urban legend. Like, it has so many good little details to it that make it fun.
There's a few real life things that tie into it that are the reason it really like kind of took off too. So before we jump into like the full thing, a shout out to the two main sources I use for today's episode. Stuart Brown's documentary Polybius from 2017. Just worth if you have any interest.
That is actually
stuff.
Super good. Yeah.
It's super good. Super good. And Brian Dunning's Skeptoid, also a really good read for you to go to. And then there's just like a million other small, even Angry Video Game Nerd. I can get a shout out because I watched his Polybius video again prior to getting ready to do this episode. Love to have him on the show at some point too. That'd be really cool. Thank you so much to Hero Forge for sponsoring today's episode. If you already know me, you know I have a tabletop RPG problem. I just love working with Hero Forge in general. So when they came, or like Sky Castle Games showed me what they were building, I got a little excited for it. It's called Wild Magic Frontier, and it's a character-driven deck-building skirmish RPG that runs right in your browser, literally nothing to install or download and stuff. And you can import your own Hero Forge mini, the actual custom minis you built, or pick from a roster of pre-made heroes, then customize your deck and step into Fractured World to carve out your own path through it. You can play solo, team up with up to two friends, and build your party together. Co-op is genuinely one click, and you just share a link straight from the browser. The game has some real depth. You forge friendships and complete quests to build a roster of companions. You go your own frontier town as you go, unlocking new characters and adventures and mechanics. And combat is this fast-paced skirmish system where the movement physics actually have some weight to them, so it feels tactile and real instead of just like numbers ticking on a screen. Every expedition you delve deeper, the wild magic gets more volatile and more powerful, and you come back with hard-earned rewards. Curating a deck and a build with real synergies, that's exactly the kind of thing I lose hours to. If this sounds like something you're interested in, head over to wildmagic.com to learn more and follow the Kickstarter page so you get notified when it launches. That's wildmagic.com. Head over there, follow the Kickstarter page so you know when it goes live. Yeah, before we go into the details, what is both of yours general knowledge of the Polybius?
I feel like I've gone deep into it before in the past, because definitely I've almost done episodes on this before. We've had a couple video game related guests on in the past where we almost did Polybius. I remember that it's like a video game cabinet with like a mysterious sort of essence to it. And that there's something about it hurting your brain and it having to do with like government research.
Yeah, probably the same amount, maybe a little less, just like, hey, it's a myth of some addictive game, you know?
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, then here's basically the pitch for you. It's like somewhere in the suburbs of Portland, Oregon in 1981, supposedly there was an arcade cabinet that, quote, should not have been there. So the arcade cabinet itself was described as black with no side art, no illustrations really on it, like no real anything to kind of like call you out of the arcade cabinet. There was no like asteroids type art on it that would have been on it at the time. It was just a straight black plain cabinet with just a name across the marquee that had just kind of a weird lettering, and that name was very simply Polybius. Supposedly, the kids who played it could not stop playing it, and the ones that couldn't stop started mentally coming apart. With headaches or nausea. Some said that they had night terrors or they had amnesia. They couldn't even remember playing it. Seizures knocked some of them to the ground. Some of them stopped sleeping entirely. And supposedly some of them stopped talking. And a few of them, depending on the version of the story you get, stopped existing. Like they just vanished from thin air.
That was me playing Destiny 2, to be honest.
For how long?
I did years. They flew by. I don't remember what happened during those years.
Me, World of Warcraft, circa 2004 to 2008.
That was like 2003 with Star Wars Galaxies.
You're right. Star Wars Galaxies is first.
Or whenever that came out. But it was college, and I had my own room in college, so I was able to really isolate.
I feel like it's a couple of times a year I lament Star Wars Galaxies. I like... ache for the times before new combat upgrade and all the stuff the Jedi Force Village.
I love
they did
the Jedi
and all that
in
stuff.
General. Oh man.
Great. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. No. Yeah. It just was one of my favorite games. I fucking love that game.
So many papers ruined.
Oh, yeah. College scores gone. I was too busy trying to be important in Star Wars Galaxies where everything was player driven. Going to farm crate dragons for their pearls. Some stuff. Anyway, every week or so with Polybius, men in dark suits, men in black, would come into the arcade. They opened up the machine and took something out of it and then would leave. They never supposedly touched the money that was on the inside. And then one day, just out of nowhere, the Polybius cabinet was gone. And when people looked it up, nobody could find a company or like a copyright or anything that belonged to the supposed game. And no cabinet in any collector's garage anywhere on Earth had a Polybius arcade. The only name that anybody seemed to be able to find attached to it was a manufacturer that nobody ever really found called Sinosokin.
Sinosloshin,
thank you. Sinosloshin. So yeah, you know that exactly. But that's the pitch of the story. That's basically the myth in a nice tight little package. And like we both know, and just to save everybody some time right up front, it isn't real. There was no such machine called Polybius. And I'm sure there are a few listeners who hear me say that and is like, well, what the fuck are we doing here for an episode then? Well, because there's actually some real documented findable stuff that is tied to Polybius that we can pull dates on. Kids in Portland arcades, for instance, genuinely did get sick in 1981 on a specific day with one specific arcade, and it actually made the paper at the time. Then men in suits did genuinely come to Portland arcades, open up the cabinets, take data out. It wasn't mysterious what they took, and left the money alone because that's all they were there for. And we even know which agency and why. Black unmarked cabinets with no art on them genuinely also did show up in arcades and vanish a few weeks later. But there's also a boring industry reason for that. Video games did put people in hospitals around this time, and there is a real mechanism behind that as well. Like, all this stuff I'm saying is that this is the bones of the actual myth. This is where it comes from, because it is a lack of information, as most things are, mixed with real world events, which is a fertile breeding ground for anyone to just start shoving theories into it that just match what's needed to make the story make sense. So we're going to kind of like, we're not going to super focus on the legend so much as I'm just going to kind of like go through it.
Disassemble the tulpa.
Disassemble the tulpa, the egregore of Polybius, real live on air right now.
You're going to open the breakfast sandwich and just eat the bacon. And then just after that, you're going to just eat the eggs.
And you're going to appreciate it for what it is. Understand why it plays a role in the sandwich. Yeah, and then you're going to go, exactly.
Yeah, I'm hungry, you guys.
You're making me hungry, dude.
I could eat.
Also, because we're old, I'm going to set a little bit up because I just don't know how much people under a certain age have any idea of how enormous arcades were. Like, though we grew up in the dying process of the arcade, there were still like USA Skates and stuff that had like a thriving arcade section, or the arcade in my local mall that I would go to with my dad every so often.
I was going to say, I think the big difference between when we were kids and when, like, you know, you think of arcades today, even if you're like being like, I've been to an arcade with old video games in it, is that like back when we were kids, the arcade was it. Like, you could go to an arcade that was just the main thing to do there was to go play video games at it. Like, it was a business that was just an arcade. And now they're all like a bar, or there's like at the movies, there's an arcade, or at the mall, there's a little arcade sometimes. But it's never like how it used to be where, like, you know, the family arcade near, I forget where that was on. Maybe it was on Vermont in LA. And there's like a couple other ones. Like, there's often at the beach, there's like dedicated arcades. Those ones are like, there was like a culture to that, like how skateboarding used to have a culture, and how like, you know, pogs or whatever, like people would like, there's like rules, and you know, you put your quarter down and it would be like, it's time for me to play next. Like, you know, there was like a vibe to it. People would like fight each other. I don't know. You'd learn secrets from talking to each other. You'd like meet people at the arcade, like how you used to probably meet people at the movies when you were younger or something like that.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. You could be like the fourth on a X-Men arcade
God, the X-Men arcade.
Or if you were lucky, you had the six player one with all the screens.
You always know when Oh my God.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
And the Simpsons arcade game, which was just so random and had really nothing to do with the Simpsons other than the characters. I remember playing that down the shore for hours on the boardwalk.
I didn't realize until I was actually doing the research for this is that the X-Men arcade, the reason the X-Men looked different than the cartoon characters is because it was based in the pilot that never got picked up.
Pride of the X-Men.
Wolverine.
Pride of the X-Men.
I didn't know that at all. I actually just watched the pilot a few days ago, and I didn't know Wolverine. He had an Australian accent, I think.
Yeah, he's like got Wolverine. The brown suit.
Totally, yeah, he's in the brown suit. He had like a different voice actor. Very different show. That's really cool. But arcades were booming around 1981. That's like where they hit their peak, 1981, 1982. Also, it's like the place where you could get the best technology. Like the games looked the best. You weren't getting games that looked like this at home. And during its peak, video game coin-operated businesses in the U.S. were pulling in more money than the movie industry and the music industry combined.
The music industry is like fucking crazy to me. That doesn't even make sense to me. But no,
think about it too. It's like all in quarters. All in quarters.
Dude, I'm okay. If I never purchased a video game at my house ever, and my room looks like Mathis is limited by the size of how big PC game boxes are.
Yeah.
How many he can fit on a shelf.
Yeah.
Blu-ray size it's cases are. Yeah. Yeah. Blu-ray cases are not so much of an issue. I've got a lot of video games over the years as a video game YouTuber, reviewer, and like video maker. And if I had never bought a single one and you translated everything that I've spent on all my consoles and all my games into quarters, like, how many quarters we're talking about.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's impossible to fathom. I didn't realize how fucking successful this industry was back then. And to kind of, again, put more perspective on this. So Pac-Man hit in 1980, and that shit was like an instant virus in society. Like that game hit, and all of a sudden there was a Pac-Man cartoon, a Pac-Man cereal, a top 40 single called Pac-Man Fever that charted.
Like, yeah, it's Pac-Mania, baby.
Yeah, there was a fucking Pac-Mania. Time magazine put video games on the cover in 1982 and that with a headline that was Gronk Flash Zap. That was the headline.
Gronk
Flash Zap.
Some copywriter was like, some copywriter like shit. That's so Raven into the future while he was riding just had a stroke and just wrote Gronk for some reason. I must write Gronk. Rob Gronkowski. He's coming. It's like when the Flash shows up to Batman. Gronk.
Arcade stupid. Machines were just fucking everywhere. And not only in just arcades, like machines were in, I don't know if you remember but I very vividly remember as a kid, even in the early 90s, like arcade machines were in like my local pizza place.
Yeah.
One. They were in, like I said, the USA Skates, the local laundromat.
Still, yeah.
And my local grocery store actually had one, I remember.
I keep thinking about buying a fucking Neo Geo machine and putting it in the laundromat and being like, listen, let's split the take on this. I feel like everybody would play if you put a fucking Neo Geo machine in a laundromat today.
100%.
Absolutely think
it's exactly the right place to play video games. People need to go back out in the world. My orthodontist
had like a little mini arcade in his waiting room, which is, you know, great for kids who are waiting to get their teeth all jacked up with the wires.
Yeah, dude, mine had a Miss Pac-Man machine in there, like a bar top one. That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like basically anywhere you could find space, you were basically shoving an arcade cabinet because it was just guaranteed money. Like it was just bringing in straight cash. And I know we talked about arcades in our kind of nostalgic view, but also like in 1981, arcades were sensory overload. You walk into one, it's dim lighting and it's fucking loud.
Yeah.
And there's my least favorite kind of human, teenagers, everywhere in this bitch. Like everywhere. Being a teenager. Teenagers do suck. We like as kids, we kind of suck a little bit. I think it's part of having to be a teenager is sucking a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, in every possible way. And then So like, sorry, Alex's face is just completely.
You good, dude?
Picture me. I'm really far away.
You good, dude?
I like this is me like distancing myself from the messaging and just like trying to check in.
It does sound like
it's just like Robert Pattinson playing Chris Hansen just starts to lean into the frame. He's like, you see how this looks, right?
I should probably, there is context to why I said that. Back in high school, way back in the day, I had the unprivilege of learning of like all the like hockey boys and like popular girls would go do rainbow lipstick parties. Did you know what that was? Do you know what that is?
I've never heard of this actually happening in my life, but
no,
I do know.
No. So this I remember.
We're talking about everybody wears different colored lipstick, right?
And then they try to make a rainbow on the dick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely happened in my school. I was informed about it.
I was informed about it.
Yeah, I wasn't popular enough to go to the.
Are you the homeless? Are you the homeless king?
There's a memorandum.
I was the anime club king.
Yeah, you're the nerds that were invisible in all the rooms were like taking information back to you, passing it to you with little pieces of paper.
My lord, they're doing it right now.
The rainbow party.
There's a memorandum of understanding passed out during homeroom. Saying this is happening, nerds.
Oh yeah, and speaking of sensory overload, you always knew that X-Men arcade machine was in the arcade.
Colossus.
Yeah.
Before you even finish that sentence, I heard it in my frontal lobe. I can still hear that voice. I'm so bummed I missed out on the opportunity to get the 1-Up arcade version of that game because
Finally came out, right? Like for real again?
Oh, long ago, and now it's not available anymore.
No, there's like I think it finally came out on like stuff, right? If you want to, like,
that'd be cool.
If you want to hook up like fight sticks to it, I know it actually came out on Mister not too long ago too. If you do update all, if you know what I'm talking about, but man, it has support for the 6-player one. That's a great cabinet.
You could buy an original for $5,000 on vintagearcade.net.
That's what I should take to the fucking laundromat. Imagine if we started like a serious X-Men community league at the. At the Laundria, whatever that thing is called across the street. I love that place.
I kind of also bring this up with the teenagers and all that stuff too, because the industry also realized that the arcades have kind of this image. Like it's loud, it's unbearable, there are kids everywhere. And in those early to mid 80s, they started purposely trying to push it away from that and make it into these more what we now nostalgize about, which is like, this kind of like warmer, fun, more place where like kids are running around and stuff too. And like parents are bringing their kids there and so on.
Oh yeah. Cause it was like kind of like an edgy place to be originally. Yes. That's what you mean. Like, yes. It was like kind of dangerous.
Started off as like the punk rock kind of place to go.
Yeah.
And they didn't, the arcade cabinet owners were like, I don't like this. We need to like rebrand so we can have, you know what every industry fucking does inevitably along the throw of time is stop.
Yeah, kind of like when Vegas tried to be family friendly for a minute there.
Yeah,
it was like come Camelot. To Vegas, it's for families, yeah. And then they're like, fuck that. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. We're done.
Yeah,
they figured out where the money was, dude. It wasn't in chicken strips. Yeah,
it was not in kids' chicken strips.
So if you were a parent in 1981 and, you know, you're now kind of your kid is like off into this dark area with like feeding machine quarters filled with like
strangers. That might be the first fall of video games right there was when they like tried to make it uncool. That's like the fall of Satan from heaven. That's like the first that's where we lost video games.
It really seriously, because this is the parents had a problem with this.
Yeah.
And it became the reaction was genuinely like enormous. And it is, I think, like the thing that has been oddly, I would say, forgotten about how influential this was about arcades back then. Because, you know, again, it's all very nostalgic. But no, this was like kids were skipping school. The kid parents worried they were all filled with fucking drugs or older people that they shouldn't be with, hanging around 14-year-olds, you know, and that this is the first time we see parents begin to worry about video games being engineered to be addictive. Yeah. This is like, now they're starting to worry. Oh God, my kid, it's all they want to do is go out there and spend all their money. Yeah. And to them, it's almost like gambling or going to a strip club. You know, they're kind of equating it to that.
And right? that's the interesting thing is it reminds me of in New York City in the 1940s, Fiorello LaGuardia and the city council banned pinball. New York City had banned pinball for over 30 years until like the late 70s or mid 70s until somebody was able to prove in a city council meeting that pinball was a skill game and not just gambling. But yeah, there's always been a bit of a moral panic
every time
just under the surface. And it makes sense that this is happening. This is 1981, you said. It makes sense because in a few years from now, in 1981, we're going to see the beginnings of the Satanic Panic.
Yes.
So it's in the zeitgeist. It's in the air in the early 80s.
And by 2026, everything free is predatory and physical ownership no longer exists.
So
they cleaned that right up. Good job, guys.
Well, we got it.
You saved gaming.
We're going to fix it.
You got it.
We're not on the verge of a new dark age.
You saved gaming. Information is still free, guys. Keep going.
I blame Ronald Reagan.
Oh, everything goes back to that fucker. Hell, you could go all the way back to the South not being punished properly if you start digging deep enough. So what happens when parents start getting fucking worried about all this shit? They start legislating, to Kevin's point. Like, so
Senator Joe Lieberman arrives.
I mean, yeah. So Mesquite, Texas, which is a suburb of Dallas, passed an ordinance barring anyone under
70.
You were going to
say, which is delicious.
Which is fucking delicious.
Which is delicious.
I love Mesquite. It passed an ordinance barring anybody under 17 from the local arcade without a parent or guardian, which is the moment I think like this is all starting to domino into like the version of arcades we grew up with. The arcade for this was an Aladdin's Castle, which was owned by Bally, and Bally sued. In that case, City of Mesquite versus Aladdin's Castle went all the way to the Supreme Court of the U.S. and got decided in 1982.
U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, it went all the way to. See, this is why like I loved doing context, baby, because it makes all the lore around Polybius really click and make sense as to why it took fire.
I thought I knew everything there was to know about Polybius. Now I'm sitting here like, Gronk.
Oh my God, Supreme Court.
Holy Gronk, dude.
But also like, never mind that. Like it also was not just happening at home. It was also happening overseas as well. The Philippines and Singapore banned arcades outright altogether, just on the grounds that they caused aggression, truancy, and a psychological addiction similar to gambling, which again, thank God for loot boxes now.
Thank God. Sponsored by Loot Crate.
Loot Crate. Are they still around?
No.
They're gone. Yeah, they've been gone for a while.
It's been a while, yeah.
Rip my Thanos, flammable Thanos oven mitts.
Oh my God, I forgot about those. Oh my God, it's whiplash. So around all this, there was kind of like a specific thing that happened in 1981 that fed this directly, which is that the competitive scene had turned kind of like, I guess, like an endurance sport, because like at that point, high scores in that era were not about skill by itself. At this point on a lot of these games, if you were good enough, you could play essentially forever on one quarter, which meant that the world record was not just like a how good you are measurement. And it was like more of a like how long you could play physically standing there measurement once you passed a certain threshold.
It's like a dance contest. Yeah.
Exactly. And that meant some people were going to do this without sleeping. So you've got kids doing 30, 40, you know, like hour sessions in some instances, standing up in public with crowds, and then in some cases, genuine local news cameras like covering how long this kid has been fucking playing this game.
That had to smell so bad.
Oh, Mike, a video game convention, I'm sure, like that waft of like a PAX East on day 4 or 3.
I can't remember who shot it. I think it got taken down because I think people probably thought it was a little bit in poor taste, but somebody shot like one of the like retro conventions with like a long lens, or at least made it look like they shot it with a long lens, like nice big widescreen footage. and like put it to the soundtrack of Kulyana's Katsi. And it was like people standing in line and like taking off their like costume helmet and just being like drenched and just sitting there smoking a cigarette and being like juxtaposed with like the plight of man in this world and stuff. And it was like, Kulyana's Katsi. That might have been Justin Silverman. That was fucking hilarious.
Well, picture that then. And so, but like, obviously the arcades are like with local news covering it are eating it up. It's all free publicity. It's bringing more and more people to the arcades, getting
skateboarding.
More and more money.
It's fucking Blink 182. It's South Park. It's a million things. Yeah.
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 But unfortunately, if you're a parent watching a TV show about a local 12-year-old who's been awake for 2 days straight in front of his fucking arcade machine, while the adults around him are cheering him on, you might be really worried for your kid who goes to the arcade every weekend with his friend. You know, so that means
I guess I mean,
in 1981, in their mindset, like,
yeah,
well, I'm never like with my kid, like, okay, like for me, and I understand what you're saying. I'm not trying to be like a dick. I understand what you mean.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I'm never like what if they're there for 2 days without eating or drinking? It's like, no, they're going to be there for like fucking 2 hours and then you're going to pick them up or they're going to walk home for dinner. Like, what are we talking about?
Yeah, yeah. If you're a parent and smart about it, they'll be fine.
I'm not saying nothing bad ever happened at an arcade. I'm just saying, bro, come on.
Yeah. Well, the worry was enough that that's when the Surgeon General got involved.
Sure.
C. Everett Koop, our favorite President Reagan Surgeon General, and who is maybe the most famous person to ever hold that job, publicly named video games as one of the top dangers to children. He even singled out Missile Command specifically as offering nothing constructive. I don't know why it was Missile Command.
It's teaching them how to bomb us. Don't you see? We have to keep the kids out of arcades.
So this is where like the basis of addiction was really worried, because he was also claiming that these things were consciously engineered to get children hooked, and the phrase he used was that kids were getting hooked body and soul. The Surgeon General of the United States is now on record saying arcade games were coming for your child's soul.
Coming for your child's soul.
Yeah.
Centipede is coming to get you.
Missile Command, a real bad one.
Missile Command is fucking... That game just gives me a headache because it's like
it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, it
flashes right in your face.
It's,
yeah,
it's the Porygon episode, just like
dead ass.
Over and over.
That shit fucked me up, dude.
But that means that this for me is the moment where, like, okay, now there's parents out there who believe, oh, these video games are actually physically doing something to my kids. They're making them addicted, it's doing something to their brains. We have to do something about it. And this is like, now we have a fertile ground. We have a fertile ground for like anything to fill in the conspiracy theory. Now we move on to the 29th of November of 1981 at an arcade in Portland, Oregon area. And a 12-year-old boy named Brian Mauro was 28 hours into trying to break the world record for asteroids, which is crazy. The record he was chasing had been set by a guy named Dennis Hernandez and had taken him about 52 hours.
This is why they need to do like tournament editions that are harder. This is crazy. Again,
that's what I said earlier. The games were just like you could master them, and it was just an endurance test. It's all it became was endurance at that point. So Brian is going for a 2-day marathon. He's trying to like break it, and of course, cameras are on him. He is, by the accounts of it, also wearing a tuxedo while he's doing this. He is drinking Coca-Cola, essentially. Continuously on camera because he is 12 and it is 1981 and that's what you would do as a kid.
Sure.
And when his hand started cramping up on him, the arcade staff would come over and start massaging his hands to keep him going.
I mean,
is he playing with the other hands then? Is it, what's the...
Yeah, I guess. This was Asteroids. So
Asteroids.
Maybe he could just move around for a minute and just like get one hand massage.
Yeah.
You could probably play one handed. I don't know.
What the fuck?
But at 28 hours, he has to stop because he has severe stomach pain. And then that's the end of his attempt. And I can imagine it's the constant Coca-Cola
yeah.
for like...
That shit can clean blood off a freeway, bro. It's like corrosive.
Got all my calories and nutrients and vitamins from Coca-Cola.
Just a pure syrup straight to my stomach. And on the same day, at the same arcade, a 14-year-old named Michael Lopez was playing Tempest with his friends, and he got a migraine. This is the first one he ever had in his life, and he left, and on the way home, he ended up collapsing in a stranger's yard. So we have two kids.
Did he live?
Yeah. Oh my God. He lived. He just had a migraine.
I don't know if you've ever had a migraine.
A migraine, my brother and my father are prone to them. And
I used to get them a lot when I was younger. Yeah.
Destroys them.
Yeah. It's like you can't even look at light. It's like crazy.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at pictures of Tempest right now. And I think that would murder Tempest a small Victorian child.
Tempest is sick. Yeah.
It's crazy.
if he had an Enchirito and he played one quarter of Tempest, he would pass away.
But I mean, I think about the synchronicity here of like the lining up of two kids in the same building on the same day. One of them got a stomach ache from 28 hours of fucking caffeine and Coca-Cola and no sleep. And one of them just coincidentally got his first migraine, probably induced by Tempest, you know, as he's playing this game. All of them are easily explainable, but unfortunately, both of them made the paper. And again, remember what I just told you about the emotional kind of like weather of this stuff at the time, because this lands now in a country that's fucking ready to take any event about these arcades and blow it up into something so much bigger. So like Tempest itself, I do want to like spend a second on here, because the Tempest actually becomes pretty central to this whole thing. And it's not really going to be a coincidence that it keeps coming up. Tempest came out in October of 1981, 1 month before that day. It's a vector game for those who have never played a vector game.
Ooh, hard to describe what a vector is. Yeah.
Literally, you have to kind of like just a picture that instead of building like a picture out on a grid of dots like everything else, it's drawing glowing lines directly with, I learned reading up versus researching this stuff, an electron beam.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
vector monitors have a brightness and a sharpness to them that nothing else at the time came close to.
You can't even really like, until you've played on a vector machine, you can't really imagine what it looks like compared to a regular screen.
There was a home vector console called the Vectrex.
Yeah.
The Vectrex. I want to get one day.
That had it. But yeah, there's a puppy.
Smitty, he hates Tempest. Smitty notoriously tried to play Tempest once and it just gave him a seizure.
But it's like, I just imagine like the lasers or the light, just it's like shooting at the screen and just into your eyes.
It's super bright. I think Asteroids also, if you've never played a vector machine, I think Asteroids is one. It is bright as shit. It is like Siri. It looks like somebody's like looking in the sun at an eclipse.
You really should be wearing those eclipse goggles if you're going to be playing on a vector machine.
Seriously, they look like fucking like radioactive. Like it's crazy.
What Tempest looks like, to try to describe it, is like kind of looks like a tunnel and you're looking down like a geometric well and things are climbing.
Yeah, it's like a vanishing point. It's like a vanishing point. Like looking,
and the whole play field is spinning and flashing in high contrast.
Yeah. Like, you're like doing the trench run basically.
Yeah, exactly.
It gets faster and faster as you go. So it's just insane. And every single description of what Polybius supposedly looked like is actually a description of Tempest. The tunnel that's described for Polybius, the geometry, the psychedelic quality of it all, even the speed of it increasing. When people say they remember a game that made them feel strange, they are actually describing a real game. It just came out 1 month before the incident and is sitting in the same room, and it was just a flashing game of hell to your eyes.
I've never played a real Tempest machine in my life. I don't know either. I've played Tempest before. I like Tempest, actually. It's on a lot of like compilations of Atari games, but I can't imagine what that would look like in a vector screen. It's so much more complex than the stuff that I usually
see. Vector machines were notoriously hard to keep running. Like they broke if the wind blew the wrong way.
They do. They just seem like some Wild West technology or something. Yeah. It's like impossible.
Well, there's also like a medical mechanism for like what was triggered too. It's just photosensitive epilepsy. I'm sure a few people on our live show discovered they might have that at the last segment.
I fucking fucked up so bad, dude.
Oh my God.
This is what I'm talking about with, Polybius. It's like, you think you develop the game and it's fine. You think about it, whatever, whatever. But then you realize like this is on a screen and we did a Q&A. I don't think anybody actually discovered that they had epilepsy at the show. I think it actually was fine, but
no, yeah. There's a dark room.
We were playing Area 51 for the PlayStation on a projector. And I was just crazy. Like, oh my God, I forgot that it was going to be like huge on the screen. Cause I've been making it on my,
you lean into the mic,
13 inch laptop. Yeah.
You lean into the mic and just said like, no, I didn't think this through. It was great.
Oh,
well,
God.
Roughly 1 in 100 people have epilepsy, and even a fraction of those people have the photosensitive kind. And that's just where flashing lights at certain frequencies or like high contrast patterns trigger a seizure. And plenty of people who have it don't even know they have it until something sets it off. Tempest was like the perfect thing to set it off on some people. So like, take that. And that's ingredient number one.
Yeah, you weren't joking about the Porygon episode, really. Like,
Yeah.
So that's ingredient number one of our sandwich here. That like the photosensitivity and Tempest and all that.
All right, we took the bacon out.
Delicious bacon.
Yeah.
It was good. Next, we moved to Saturday, the 3rd of April in 1982, and an 18-year-old named Peter Burkowski walked into Friar Tuck's game room in Calumet City, Illinois, with a friend around half past eight in the evening. And he played another game we briefly discussed on the show, I think even in the same episode with it. He played Berserk. Berserk is a maze shooter where you're running through rooms filled with robots trying not to get touched, and there's a bouncing, smiling face.
This is a weird game.
It is a super weird game. Yeah,
what does he says something. He's like, he
says something like this.
Can't remember what he says.
I don't either. He's a bouncing, smiling face called Evil Otto that chases you, cannot be killed, cannot be stopped.
Wow.
It's one of those like nasty pieces of like old school hard game design.
Sure.
This kid played for about 15 minutes. He got his initials onto the high score list with that. And then he turned to put a quarter into another machine, and instead he collapsed and he died.
Holy shit.
Jesus Christ.
Now, obviously, there's a medical reason for what happened to him. The autopsy found that he had a pre-existing heart condition and that he had scar tissue on his heart that was estimated to be a couple of weeks old, meaning something had already happened to him before he even walked into the arcade.
He had like a heart attack or something and he didn't even realize it at some point.
Exactly. He was just an 18-year-old kid with an undiagnosed cardiac problem, and it killed him. And where it happened to kill him was just the arcade. It was very coincidental. That part's real. But it's in the Chicago Tribune. Like this, we know of this. His name is Bukowski. You can look it up. Bukowski, which I just mentioned because it is also misspelled Burkowski in about 90% of everything written about him, but it's Bukowski, B-U-K, not Burkowski,
story B-U-R-K. Story of researching shit for a show like this.
No
like,
shit. Yeah, you just get used
dude,
to it. This
people are so story. Wrong. Oh, I found Evil Otto's voice, by the way. It goes like this.
Tuner alert, intruder alert.
Yeah, that, having that thing chase you and you can't do anything about it. Hey, it's horrifying. God.
Yeah.
Have either of you played UFO 50?
Oh my God!
Yes.
So okay. Awesome.
So like Barbuda, the first game on the has that like face thing that chases you around.
Exactly.
I hate it. Mario Brothers 2 in the U.S. Same thing has that like evil face when you pick up the key.
Oh yeah, yeah, the evil face.
Yeah.
When you get the key, yeah.
So within 6 months or about 6 months of Peter Bukowski dying, a second death shows up in the print, and the second death actually happened first
because of Berserk.
Well, the story goes that in January of 1981, more than a year before before Calumet City, a 19-year-old named Jeff Daly played an intense session of Berserk, put up a high score of 16,660, and then dropped dead of a heart attack standing right in front of that machine.
666 in his score, bro?
Yeah.
Damn.
Whoa. Synchronicity.
Whoa.
Satan's game.
666 between 1 and 0, dude?
Yeah.
Oh shit.
Oh shit. And the detail everybody like repeats is the score. Actually, you're not wrong, Alex, is like they do repeat that 16,666. If you just knock off a zero and the one, you've got 666 in the score.
Oh, shit, bro.
You just, it's there. It's right there.
Hear me out. That's the mark of the beast.
Oh.
It's going to move on. The problem is doing your research. Jeff Daly, the guy who supposedly died of this, doesn't exist.
Oh, shit. Wait. So.
We have no, but it still took off. That's the thing. Like, it's again, it's conspiracy theory had taken off about
Jeff,
this.
I scored 666 Daly.
Never existed.
Never existed.
I could not find any news coverage about his death. There's no wire story, no local paper, nothing. Dude, for what is supposedly the first video person ever killed by a video game in a year when the American press could not get enough stories about video games hurting kids. So, like, the absence should have been like, the absence is the evidence in my mind.
Yo,
that there is
what if the game just like took him out of like the timeline? Like, he raised him from existence. So like he never existed in the first place. But there's some Mandela effect.
Oh, we merged timeline.
We merged. There was a timeline merge or split.
If there are people out there who were alive at that time and who believe truly like that
you knew him.
They knew. Yeah, they knew, or they remember seeing papers about it or something. I'm very curious.
And then when they went and looked at that Berserk game again, the smiley face had devil horns and he was red.
Yeah. Oh shit. And then Pony Island prequel.
On the cabinet art, it was Jeff going like,
oh my god, that'd be sick.
It looks like he's banging.
Yeah.
And he has the high score still.
And he has
to this day,
the eternal no high score.
What I did find, though, is that other people did some work more than I was doing. And other people were able to find a Jeffrey Daly of about the right age who died in the U.S. in 1981. He was a young man from Virginia, but he didn't die of a heart attack. He died in a car crash in May of that year, nowhere near an arcade, and who was buried out in Virginia. Like there was a dude named Jeff Daly, but like doesn't seem to be attached. The Daly story is usually pinned to Friar Tuck's, which is the same place Peter Bukowski died. Friar Tuck's also, like, what the lore doesn't tend to notice is that it actually didn't open until 1982, when this person's death supposedly happened in 1981. So the timelines of them happening
This is Quinky Dinks. This is Doodoo Berries.
Exactly.
This is Quinky Dinks, bro.
Imagine being such a Robin Hood fan, though, that you name a arcade Friar Tuck in 1982. That's like a dead zone for Robin Hood people, you know.
Yeah. Friar Tuck too is like not like the cool guy in that.
Not the cool guy from the story.
He's kind of like the pot smoking dude. Like he's not a
man of action.
He's the Chumley of the group.
So like we have a fertile ground here, right? Even like to note, like even the creator who designed Berserk, Alan McNeil, made public pushbacks that two people had died on his game. So like, look, before Polybius is even in the zeitgeist yet, like this is before the internet, all that stuff. The arcade world
stories were still spreading. Yeah.
A fake death invented specifically to turn a real death into something grander. And it worked so well that like 40 years later, it's still really repeated out loud, like in public.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure I've written that in a listicle before, like in one of the many terribly paid video game journalism jobs I've held over the years.
Now we have like ingredient kind of two here, but ingredient three is a quick one. We can even kind of loop it into ingredient two.
It's just mustard. It's just English mustard. Delicious.
Yeah, exactly. It's just English mustard. 10 days after Brian Mauro and Michael Lopez both got sick in the Portland arcade, the FBI raided multiple arcades in the Portland area. Like that actually happened. Federal agents in Portland in arcades literally were 10 days later, were raiding them. So now we have our men in suits showing up from the lore.
They raided,
but the reason isn't because people died at the arcade. The reason is gambling.
Hmm.
Remember what I told you about the part of the at the top about an arcade cabinet being full of fucking cash, like in a room? Some arcade operators had figured out that with some modification, you can turn a video game into a gambling machine. You could play, rack up a score, and then the guy behind the counter pays you out. And the cabinet does the, like, it's like a toy. You're like operating through the arcade
machine.
That's
crazy. Okay, so
it's nuts.
If I was like spending my money in a way that I was gambling, that would not be the way that I would do it. Just so you know, like, that's crazy. Like a game where you just like fuck up and die.
Yeah, but people were just betting like that they could like, you know, X will get to Y or whatever. It's crazy.
I would have assumed if gambling was not on the top five, that was not on the Family Feud top five.
No,
for me, I would have gone with like money laundering would have been pretty easy to do with. It's like a cash
quarters. It's all situation. Cash, yeah.
You know, pretty simple, but
nope, they were gambling. Okay. They were gambling, which immediately kind of explains why the FBI gave a shit at all.
They're like, my nephew, Fiorino, he can beat Donkey Kong faster than anybody here. I bet you $1 million my nephew could beat you with Donkey Kong.
I bet you $100 that he's going to jump over the first barrel clean. It's going to be clean.
Clean.
I swear to God, he's not going to touch that barrel. He's going over clean.
There's not going to be a pixel overlap.
Who's got money on this? Put some money down.
And it's crazy because now we literally turn a room that's children's entertainment into a functioning, unlicensed casino in cash that produced no records whatsoever, which means it was also a very convenient way to move money that would rather not be counted.
And there's the money laundering.
There, yeah, exactly. It's there. It's always there. And like that, those two things are what bring FBI to your fucking door, knocking on your door to just like, you know, see what's going on. And here's how they investigated it, which is super fun. In the lead up to those raids, agents went into arcades and opened up the cabinets. They were checking whether the machines had been physically tampered with, whether the boards had been modified for payouts. And while they had the machines open, they were reading the screens and writing down the high scores. These top 10 lists with these three letter initials on them were a list of the arcade's most frequent regulars by this point, which means it was a witness list. The high score list became a fucking witness list.
Dude, what a cockamamie idea for a casino.
Right?
They but fucked now, this. This is on them. Is. They this blew
is,
this.
This is our men in suits coming into the arcade, opening up cabinets quietly, not touching the money, but instead taking the data machine, writing down numbers, showing zero interest in the money, and then walking out and leaving because they were investigating money laundering and casino like shit going on. It's crazy.
That is literally fucking insane.
So then you have like the next week you have like some kid at the in the playground saying, hey, I saw the kids also from the Italian New York diaspora. He goes, hey, I saw the men in black over there and my friend Jeff Daly died.
Is that the devil boy? I don't want you to bring it. Don't you dare bring his name into this establishment. This is a Catholic establishment.
Sign of the cross.
Don't you dare bring the 666 boy in here.
Praise be to God. Praise be to God.
Get him out of here.
Anyway, you wanted to play Tempest.
Dude, and so the next link to this being like Tempest, linking Tempest to being Polybius is that there are accounts of federal agents putting surveillance equipment inside the arcade cabinets in that era, and which if you take a second to think it makes sense because you're investigating what is happening in the room while you're not there, and a video game cabinet is one of the single best places to install listening devices on the inside of it.
Are you talking about for crime?
Yeah, for gambling and money laundering.
So they were like putting surveillance equipment in the casino to like the way that you look for card counters.
Well, no, I guess I don't know how they do that, but they open up the arcade machines, put listening devices in the inside of it and whatnot, close it,
catch gamblers.
Yeah, because they would have, you know, the owners would come over and have to like pay them out and all that stuff. Like there's conversation that they had.
This is
just the worst casino.
This is the dumbest shit I've ever heard.
This is so dumb.
Video game nerds think they found a cheat code in real life, and they did not. And again, the reason Tempest loops into this is because reportedly the Tempest cabinet was the favored cabinet because there was an enormous amount of space on the, in the display because it was a vector machine. So it was just like, there's a lot of room back to put this shit.
So not only is it the mind control machine because of the headaches that it would create, but also just by chance, because of its size, also it can fit cameras inside. So because it fits cameras inside and gives you a headache, it was government research?
Yeah.
That's fucking...
Do you see it all coalescing?
This is like...
I didn't even really realize.
This is like the type of shit that I would have focused on in an episode if I wrote about this. This is awesome.
It's so weird. It's so weird. So we have like, I'd say one ingredient really left. And I'd say it's the most specific and vividly detailed in the whole legend. And it's the one that always sounds like it has to be invented. The cabinet itself. The part, like, who would make an arcade cabinet that has zero advertising on it, no art on it? All there is just a supposed name on the arcade cabinet. And it was super popular, but nobody knows the name of the thing because there's no name and there's like nothing on it to like indicate it. But if you do your research, this actually happened all the time for it. And the industry term for it was called location testing. The problem an arcade company had in 1981 was you have now built a game. You just don't know if it's any good. You can't really ask people because people are terrible at predicting what they're going to spend their money on. What you actually need to know is whether a real teenager with a quarter would walk up to your arcade with 40 other machines competing for it, and with that quarter, pick yours to spend their time and money on, and whether he will do it again and again. It's reminded me a little bit of like algorithms. You know, it's like the earliest binary mechanism of algorithm, right? The arcades are the ones and the quarters are the ones and the zeros, and you're seeing where quarters are being spent the most. So what they did was you would build a cabinet, put your prototype in it, and then just quietly rent out a spot and put in a couple of arcades and just see the earnings. Atari actually did this. A lot of people ended up doing this. And a location test cabinet just didn't have art on it because art costs money and you commission it once the game is going to go into production, whether you know your prototype will make money.
Makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah. It makes complete market sense. It's just so what ends up happening is you get a plain black box with a name silk screened or taped onto the marquee, and then that's it. There's no announcement. They don't do anything. It just mysteriously shows up in your arcade one day, is there for a couple months. Nobody knows about it. They start playing it. And if it's popular, people get confused when it mysteriously disappears a couple months later after the test, because that wasn't the full product. So that's
amazing.
That's your mysterious black box cabinet. Was just market testing. It was QA before like QA was a thing in video games that teams do now.
It makes perfect sense. Like it doesn't even seem like mysterious to me, but it's like the notion of being a kid or not understanding anything about where arcade games come from, which as I do more video game stuff in my life, as I go on through the years, I find that almost no one understands the video game industry in any way. And it's just like, it's just so funny to imagine it from that perspective where you're like, oh, machine gone. Where machine go?
Yeah.
No, oh, it must be mystery machine. What happened?
You have kids, teenagers who are just like fucking dumb. And then you have a bunch of adults involved who are just like incurious. Like they don't really care to dig any further than the surface level.
Right.
So you get these newspaper articles. We're like, the kid died at the machine. And then you have the replication of these. It's basically a viral myth of like, hey, there was a machine that killed kids. And it just spreads.
It's fascinating.
And you want to spice it up yourself, right? To like kind of sell the story when you tell it. So it just gets spicier as time goes on. Yeah.
I love like dissecting this shit because it's so interesting. What little things had to all happen at the same time to really build this.
Fuck yeah.
And as far as the gameplay is concerned, we talked about Tempest, but like there was also another game that people may have been mixing into this. And it was a game called Cube Quest, which for the time had some unbelievable visuals for its time, and it broke down. But the thing is that the game broke down constantly, and it was needing service constantly, which means there was also a guy at the machine that opened it every few days mysteriously and didn't take the money.
This looks crazy.
Wow.
Right. Yeah, I know. It looks crazy. But it broke down all the time.
Yeah.
And Tempest itself, one more time, which had a genuinely troubled release and got pulled and patched all the time because early units had a bug that could give players free games, and Atari had to go out and fix that shit in the field, which means there's a real 1981 scenario where a strange machine appears, has technical problems, gets visited repeatedly by men who open it up and do work inside it, and then it gets taken away.
And has insane graphics that look like totally.
It looks
nuts.
Like the future. The future has arrived.
Like it really has arcade. Like a lot of tubes in it too. Like it really does look like you're flying down a psychedelic tube like this entire game, much like Tempest.
Just comparing like the pixel, the rastered images that you're seeing in most arcade games. And then the first time you see it, people probably saw a vector machine. They had to have lost their shit because it was the future. It looks smooth.
Yeah, it looks.
I'm looking at the word 2050. It's forever from now.
Yeah,
but the future is now.
It is,
and it comes with migraines.
Yeah, lots of migraines and lots of gambling. Like weirdly, both of those things huge right now in the future.
Absolutely massive. So to me, like the next obvious question then is, if this is all happening, then when did the legend show up? Because at this point in time, Polybius, the name Polybius is not there. It's not in the rumors. There's rumors that like the weird machines, but it all is just the fertile breeding ground of the stuff. And as people have gone looking really hard for any trace of the Polybius rumor around that time, or even in the 90s, the earliest rumor we can seem to find is like, well, we have arcade trade magazines from the period, which covered this industry obsessively and would have loved like a story of that topic. Didn't happen. Not a mention. It seems Polybius' start date is the 6th of February, the year 2000. That seems to be the first. How many topics have we recently done, Alex, where like the rumor seems to have been started decades later?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like the entertainment industry is like the need to be interesting has just created the willingness to just kind of like make something up.
Yeah. Right. Well, where did this come from? People who have done the work prior to me. We're able to find a website called coinop.org, which is actually super cool, genuinely useful website. It's a database and digital museum of arcade machines. And the guy who ran it is named Kurt Koller. And on the 6th of February in 2000, an entry appeared on that site for a game called Polybius. The entry lists it as copyrighted in 1981, but no such copyright actually exists. It lists the manufacturer as Sindelslauschen. It says it had a very limited release, one or two Blackwater arcades in a suburb of Portland, and that it was developed by some kind of weird military tech offshoot group, and that it is used proprietary behavior modification algorithms developed for the CIA, and it lists most of the actual factual fields as unknown. And whoever posted it claimed to have a ROM image of the title screen from which fragments had been extracted, including the year and the company name.
I feel like I've seen this before.
Probably have.
Yeah.
Nobody has ever seen that ROM, though. And then somebody made sure people knew about it sometime before September 2003. Kurt Koller sent a tip about Polybius to GamePro magazine, which I was subscribed to. I loved GamePro, which at that point, claimed to be the biggest independent multi-platform gaming magazine in the world. Again, I think that's true. GamePro ran it in a feature called Secrets and Lies. And the way they handled it is what we're going to look at. They didn't say it was true, but they did not say it was also fake. They simply declared the game's existence as inconclusive.
So that's why it's like ever held on as a,
yeah.
As a, yeah.
Because Kurt Collar, the person who supposedly put this up there, sent this tip. There was no way for them to verify the tip. So they were like, you know, inconclusive at this point. And it's a national level video game magazine. So immediately this is going to be fuel for more.
It feels like it's basically just a pre-creepypasta. Like, there's so many creepypastas about video games. It just feels like an early version of that that just got a little bit out of hand because there was just no people weren't looking into, they're kind of taking things on face value still. They're like, it's on the, well, there's people who are like, there's no, you can't believe anything on the internet. And then there's people who are like, oh no, we post real things on the internet. And coming from a site that is supposed to be a database, a reputable database of arcade games, and ending up in GamePro. Yeah, I could see how this ended up taking on a life of its own, mixed in with everything else that happened in 1981. Everything kind of get blended together into a slurry.
Especially if you're like specifically writing it, right? Like, it's like kind of makes sense, like, you know, wanting to make something that sounds believable. So you get a lot of details from a lot of different sources, like,
right,
on purpose together. It's like, you know, it's not just like confusion. It's like somebody really tried to make it seem real.
Yeah. Well, the documentary, Stoop Brown, the guy who did the documentary I watched, he's kind of the one that did, like, really tried to find the origin as to why any of this was going on. And his conclusion of it was that Polybius was an international hoax created by Kurt Collar simply to drive traffic to coinop.org. He's trying to be like a viral, come to my website, see what's going on here kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he also found that people who were certain that they, like Mandela effect style, remembered reading about Polybius on something called Usenet in the mid 90s, part of his research, they were likely remembering a completely different thing called Publius Enigma.
Yep.
This, which was a genuine and much stranger mystery. Alex, this felt like so up your alley.
We did this. We talked about this.
It did sound fucking familiar. Yeah. So this is
the Pink Floyd one, right?
Correct. Yeah. It's the Pink Floyd album and the anonymous internet posts, all that stuff. Go listen to it. Well, what episode was that? Was it super? Do you remember?
It's in one of the Corner Fest type episodes.
Yeah. So again, but it's so close to Polybius, Polybius, very Roman sounding names. One real internet mystery, but the other one fake, made up 19 years
Polybius,
later.
Publius. Yeah.
And he also pointed out that the Polybius logo on the original CoinOp page has a strong family resemblance to the logos of real arcade games of the area of the era, specifically Robotron and Bubbles. Mm. And once it was out, it did what these things do now, honestly, which is it became viral on the internet. It just went everywhere all at once at the same time online. It got into the retro gaming forums and then onto early creepy internet stuff, which in the mid 2000s was hitting its stride with just like weird, creepy internet SCP, you know, that kind of spooky spaghetti shit. And Polybius arrived preloaded kind of with everything that scene was looking for. The combination of government mystery, lost artifact, a missing ROM, just enough evidence uploaded online.
Believable. That crazy. Yeah.
He did a very good job at leaking weird things. You know, if the Backrooms was in the early 2000s, like that kind of stuff, I feel like would take fire in a different way.
Like, because I really thought this was older too. I genuinely thought this was an old story.
Right. But it's like not that old in reality. And then in 2017, Jeff Minter, who's a legendary game designer, made an actual game called Polybius on purpose, which you can go buy right now. And there is now a real Polybius from 2017, 36 years after the fake one never existed. And then there's Cineslashin, which it's supposed to be German. It's not good German, though. It is a mashup of a word for sense and perception and a word for erasing and extinguishing. So it's trying to say something like sense deletion to a German speaker. It apparently reads as a clumsy compound that a native speaker would not ever like make. It is what a company name that looks like when an English a lot of people say basically it's what a company name from an English speaker who doesn't know German would make. To make a secret, sinister
just
German
make
company.
It seem cool. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's really like the most menacing detail of it all. As time went on, the claims got picked apart In an interview, he attributed the origin of the name Sinneslauschen to a German man he knew as Ulrich Koller, which is the same surname as the man who runs coinup.org. Like, yes, people keep pulling it apart. Basically by 2009, we now know fully there is a fake game and everything had gotten pulled apart. And what we were left with is a really compelling mystery with a really fascinating origin story who one day some designer would take inspiration from and create Polybius. Have you played the Polybius game from 2017? I never did.
I'm sure I've turned it on, but I've not like ever like gone ham and gotten into Polybius.
Yeah. Oh, puppy time wants to be free.
It makes me feel good, you know, knowing that I'm not the only guy with a dog that makes sound.
Exactly. I just keep mine banished downstairs.
I get it.
Yeah, my dog was very my wife and daughter came home and my dog was very upset that he was in the room. So
fair enough.
He just couldn't believe he was where he was and he lost.
So that kind of leads us to the end. And the reason this whole thing kind of took off. We have a perfect breeding ground for lots of rumors back in the day of like mysterious, weird things. And then somebody in 2003 creating something that was unfalsifiable by design to create some sort of viral marketing scheme to get people to come to his coinop.org website. Eventually it is created, but at the end of the day, we are left with the truth. A lot of complicated things happened during a very weird couple of years, which built perfect place for anybody to grab hold and feed the online internet mystery machine. And we ended up with Polybius 19 to 20 years after Polybius was supposed to have existed. That's the episode.
Crazy, crazy, so crazy. Much,
yeah.
Yeah.
Did you learn something new today about Polybius? Was it worth?
I certainly did. Episode?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Is kind of dissecting this. This is kind of cool. It actually reminded me, either you played that visual novel, The Uncle Who Works at Nintendo.
It's like no.
It's like a horror visual novel came out, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago or so. But basically, you are just, it's a guy, a kid goes over to his friend's house for a sleepover. And the uncle, and he's, the kid's like, oh yeah, I got a new game. It's from my uncle who works at Nintendo. And there's a time sense of urgency where the uncle is coming to visit and shit gets weirder and weirder as the uncle gets closer to visiting. And when he arrives, basically it becomes like House of Leaves stuff where everything is not that. Real. But yeah, the uncle who works in Nintendo is
I'm going to have to look that. That sounds,
you had, I'm you very House into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very into that. Yeah. I like the idea of that. Knowing that this became like a meme after the fact and gained its historical credibility like instantly, like I think you should keep that in mind, listener. I think you should just keep that in mind. It's pretty freaking crazy.
Remembering,
yeah, Kevin, thank you so much for coming on the show with us today.
Thanks for having me.
If people want to check out Pixelit, which is a show where, if you didn't catch it from our intro, where people read video game adaptations that are novels, right? Like, kind of like do like a book club review of them. And it was a fever dream of a read for me.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yes.
I'm sure they're not all like ridiculous nonsense. I'm sure some of them are kind of legit or cool.
You would be surprised how many are actually not just nonsense.
If you want to check out that show, where should people go, Kevin?
Yeah, we're Pixelit Podcast on basically every podcast platform you can throw a stick at: Apple, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Cast, whatever. And then we're also on YouTube. We're looking for fresh subscribers on YouTube. So go ahead to subscribe on the YouTube version if you're feeling, you know, gamey.
Just, fuck it,
just, yeah, fuck it.
Yeah.
Spicy, go over
and hit sub on YouTube. Line. Hell yeah.
Sub, hit it and hit the bell. Why not? Yeah.
Ding ding.
Oh my God, the bell. Forgot.
Get those notifications.
The bell.
Get ding those notifications.
Get that notification.
Tickle the scrot of the bell.
Tickle the scrot of the bell. What the
We're adding off to patreon.com/IlluminatiPod to go do a minisode. Thank you all so much. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. We appreciate you. We love you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Illuminati Podcast. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by the
I don't know who they are. There's two.
What?
Terrence Hill and Bud Spencer.
No.
Neo and Trinity.
No.
I don't understand, and I probably never will. Let me just tell you right now that there's two. Leon Kennedy and Claire Redfield.
I'm telling you, I think he literally just looked up famous duos.
Cheech and Chong.
And has been going through the list ever since.
I'm trying to dig deep. Which one of you is Dick Powell?
Me?
Your name's Jesse Cox.
I want to lose your I want my mind. I want to lose your I want my mind.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Chilluminati podcast. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by Alex and Jesse. Like a shooting star across the sky that's actually a UFO.